Hi, thanks for listening to one of our Sunday talks from the Center for Spiritual Living in Midtown Atlanta. If this is your first time listening to one of our talks, we certainly hope you enjoy it. But if you're a regular listener to our podcast, we would like you to consider contributing to our center. It's easy to do. All you have to do is go on our website, and it's easy to find the button and make a contribution. That will allow us to continue bringing these talks to you on a regular basis in the future. Once again, thanks for listening.
When I started studying this philosophy, it's not a religion, this philosophy that we call the science of mind a number of years ago, back in 1986, I wasn't sure exactly what I was looking for. I had some friends who had mentioned it, and so I just went and showed up. I was, however, pretty sure of what I was not looking for. For example, I was not looking for salvation, all right, because I had long ago stopped believing that any reasonable or compassionate God would ever condemn anybody to eternal damnation, no matter what they did. So I believed everybody was already saved, including me, which didn't go over well with some of my more traditional friends, but it worked anyway. And I also wasn't looking for a religion that would put me on better terms with God, because I felt pretty comfortable at the time in my relationship with whomever or whatever it was that appeared to be running the world. There's a story in that, wonderful story was told about the very wise and spiritual poet Walt Whitman. We all remember reading that back in high school and college. He died back in the late 1892, he died actually. And Walt Whitman had been quite a hellraiser in his youth. And when he was lying on his deathbed at 72 years old, which is what happens when you're a hellraiser in your youth sometimes, anyway, one of his elderly aunts, who was a very angry, self-righteous, and extremely religious Christian, funny how those words sometimes go together with so many people, she came to visit him, even though she hadn't spoken to him in years. And she didn't stay long, she just sort of sat there. But right before she left, she looked at him very sternly and said, "Well, Walter, have you finally managed to make your peace with God?" And Whitman looked at her and smiled, and he said, "I didn't know we were quarreling." Which is really kind of a good statement. That's sort of the way I felt when I showed up here. Unlike some people, I wasn't angry at God. I wasn't angry about my religious upbringing, and I couldn't think of any reason why God would be angry with me either. But I did want to expand my spiritual awareness, and I wanted to do it in a way that made sense to me. So when I heard the man who was on the stage at the Rich Auditorium over at Woodruff, many of you know him, Dr. Kennedy Schultz, when I showed up the first day, and that's a much larger auditorium than this, but I was in the last row back in that direction over there so I could get out quick if I didn't like it. That's why I was sitting there. And when I heard him say that this was a teaching based on love and law instead of salvation and redemption, that caught my attention. It did. Because finally I had heard something on a Sunday morning that made sense. It made sense to me. I like the love part, love and law. I like the love part because love and peace and joy seemed to be a lot more appealing to me than anger and judgment. And I also remember thinking that a loving creator was a lot more likely to have a sense of humor, which was important to me. I wanted more of a George Burns, Morgan Freeman kind of a God than a Charlton Heston kind of a God, okay? That was my preference, all right? But it was the law part that really appealed to me, because I always like to know exactly what I'm working with. I was an engineering degree, and, you know, many years as a pilot, so I'm not too crazy about arbitrary rules, especially if I don't make them. But I like the idea of a universe that was based on spiritual laws, just like the physical universe is based on physical laws. I liked all that. But this was even more than that. If, as this teaching tells us, the spiritual universe is actually the foundation behind the physical universe, all right, that is, if this visible material world that we move around in and do all our stuff in is really nothing more than a reflection of a logical, powerful, but invisible world, then that has to mean that these mental and spiritual laws that I was hearing about for the first time would allow anyone who understood them to consciously use these laws, all right, using their thoughts and using their emotions to change the world around them. To me, that explained a lot of things that had never been explained before. It explained to me how prayer worked, and it explained to me how the world worked. And once I understood this, I could start to see it. That meant we could actually use spiritual laws to change our life into anything that we desired. We could create what we wanted, and we could eliminate forever the things that we didn't want. And in my own personal search for spiritual meaning, those were ideas that fit what I was looking for absolutely perfectly. However, as I went along, as the years passed, I found out that learning what these laws are and learning the best way to use them does take a slightly different way of thinking than most of us are used to. I mean, it's not all that difficult, but it does take a certain shift in our perspective. Because, as I soon found out, there is no master list written down anywhere of spiritual laws. There isn't one single book, all right, anywhere, with all the definitions and all the answers. Nobody came down from a mountain with the spiritual laws carved, you know, in stone, 10, 12, however many of them that there were. These laws are just there doing what they do like they've been doing since the beginning of time. There's no instruction manual. So instead of one single book that has them all listed in order of importance or degree of difficulty, which would have made it so much easier, we have a whole lot of different people from different cultures giving us their interpretation. From Moses to Deepak Chopra, you know, from Jesus to Dr. Phil. You got the whole spectrum in between, all right? In fact, these laws don't even have names. They don't. Now, we've given them names, as we always do with stuff that we're trying to understand and trying to explain. We talk about the law of non-resistance and the law of giving, receiving, and the law of least effort and all sorts of different laws like that. But that's just to help us talk about what we see. It's just to help us describe what these laws do as far as we've been able to comprehend so far. But the real truth is, these laws function far more than we know. They function far beyond our present level of knowledge. In fact, I would even venture to say that the level of which most of us are using these spiritual laws in comparison to what they could be doing for us, if we ever learned how to really use them, is about on a par with cavemen discovering fire. I really think there's that much distance between what we know and what we need to learn. I believe that that's fine. All right, as long as we keep learning and we keep growing both mentally and spiritually, which is exactly what this teaching tells us that we should do. In fact, Einstein, I love reading about Einstein, he was a very spiritual person. When someone once asked him about his religion, he said this. Listen, it's a statement here, it's great. He says, "My religion consists of a humble admiration of the unlimited superior spirit which reveals itself in the slight details that we are able to perceive with our frail and feeble mind." Very, very interesting statement. Now, he wasn't criticizing our intelligence. He was just pointing out where he thought we were in terms of where we could someday be in understanding and using this laws. So this morning, I want to do something. I want to go sort of back to basics. I want to take one of those spiritual laws, one of the more common ones that most of us have heard about, and explore what we think we know about it as compared to what greater things we could be using it before. And as Doug said, I'm going to be talking about, the title of my talk, that good old law of attraction. Everybody's heard of that one, right? Anybody not heard of the law of attraction? Good. I got the right crowd. Okay. Now, I chose that particular law for a number of different reasons. For one thing, it's simple, but it's not too simple, all right? And it seems to work at a number of different levels. Of course, just like any principle, which is another word that we use interchangeably with the word law, the law of attraction doesn't have any levels at all. It just does what it does. But our understanding of the law, all right, and our consequent ability to use it does have many different levels, all right, which only goes to show that the laws themselves never change, but our understanding of them does. That's very important. Now, I also want to talk about it because this is a law that most of us use to make our life both easier and harder. We use it both ways, all right, until we finally figure out how to use it intentionally and productively. So it's an excellent metaphysical tool, all right? And finally, I like talking about the law of attraction because once we do discover what it does, all right, and why it works the way it does, we'll have a much better understanding, not just about how the world works, but more importantly, about how our mind works and how this creative power that we call God is always working through us in order to create a better life that reflects the spiritual wonder of the universe that has been ours to enjoy from the very beginning. In fact, that's what all of these spiritual laws do. They allow us to make use of gifts from the universe that we've always had, but didn't know we had, by using both our intelligence and our desire for something better. Now, in our what we call our textbook, which is The Science of Mind by Dr. Ernest Holmes, written back in the 1920s originally, Dr. Holmes has dedicated an entire chapter to the law of attraction. It's chapter 18, for those of you who like to take notes. And near the beginning of this chapter, he writes this. And listen to it through a filter of the 1920s language. But listen, he says, "Thought can attract to us that which we first mentally embody, that which has become a part of our mental makeup and a part of our inner understanding." And then he says, "Every person is surrounded by a thought atmosphere." By a thought atmosphere, sort of like Doug was talking about the broadcasting statement. He says, this mental atmosphere, he says, is the direct result of our conscious and unconscious thought, which becomes the direct reason for and cause of that which comes into our life. Now, even allowing for the archaic language, that's pretty straightforward. Because what he is saying is that whatever is in our consciousness, whatever thoughts and emotions we are most occupied with on a regular basis, is constantly creating an atmosphere or an energy field, or an energy field or a vibration, whatever you want to call it, around us that attracts to us the people and the things and the situations in life that reflect our deepest state of mind. That's pretty straightforward. But if we look at what he says even more closely and make a few logical assumptions, there are some other things that it tells us too. Now, for one thing, it tells us that there is not some cosmic random crisis generator out in the universe somewhere constantly throwing problems at us just sort of randomly that we neither want nor deserve. In other words, it tells us, we can assume, that everything in our life, good or bad, easy or hard, pleasant or unpleasant, desirable or undesirable, is in our life for one reason and one reason only, because it perfectly matches something that is firmly entrenched in our consciousness, whether we know it's there or not. That's the hard part. So that means our problems, so to speak, are not in our life because of our parents or the government or our ex or the Republicans or the Democrats or anybody else or Russia or any of that stuff, okay? And any undesirable situation in our life will stay with us like a bug on flypaper, or as they say in Georgia, like a tick on a dog, okay? As long as whatever is attracting it remains a part of our conscious or unconscious beliefs or opinions. That's what it means. Now, another thing that a deeper understanding of this law will tell us is that we all have an absolutely foolproof and readily available method of cleansing our consciousness. We all have it, every one of us, and we can use it or not, but it's always there. And ignorance of it is no excuse. Emerson had a great statement in one of his lectures. I love it. He says, it's very simple. He said, "Life is the mirror of king or slave." Great statement. Life is the mirror of king or slave, which means everything we see out there is a reflection of what is in here. And that is a very valuable piece of information. If we keep running into difficult people, for example, all right, that should tell us something useful about our beliefs. If we can't seem to find work that we love, or can't seem to find a person we love, or can't seem to bring in enough money to do the things we love, that is giving us some very valuable information that we can use to change our belief, and in that way change our experience. But sometimes, especially in the beginning, when we're just starting out, when we're just getting used to this way of thinking, we may need to get clear at first what our life experience is not telling us. Sometimes we have to start there. For example, our experience, our challenge, our problem, whatever it happens to be, is not telling us that we are a bad or incompetent person that no one likes. It's not telling us that. It's not telling us that God is not on our side, so to speak. And it's not telling us that life is hard and then you die. It's not telling us any of those things. All this mirror that we call life is telling us is that there's something in here that is amplifying the energy we're putting out, and that energy is attracting those things to us. That's all it's telling us, just like a mirror tells us what our clothes look like. It's really that simple. Now, there's a proven scientific basis for how this law works. So I want you to think back to fifth grade science class, okay? Remember when the teacher put you in little groups and brought out a piece of paper and sprinkled iron filings on it? Remember that one? Then what'd you do? You put a magnet underneath it, right? Okay. As soon as the energy field of the magnet through the paper touched the iron filings, what happened? The iron filings took a shape, but they took the shape of the magnetic field, not the magnet. All right, if it was a horseshoe-shaped magnet, it didn't take a horseshoe shape. So they took the shape of the invisible field, not the magnet. And if we change the magnet by changing the electrical energy going through it, if it was an electromagnet, or by using a different magnet, then the arrangement of the iron filings quite simply changed too. But, and this is the important part, the iron filings themselves didn't change. They did not change at all. They just responded. They were simply rearranged by a certain kind of attracting energy, in this case, a magnetic energy. My point is, it was the energy that created the pattern. So the intelligence, which is what the energy was, not the magnet, not the iron filings, the energy, the intelligence acted, and the substance, sort of like substance out there, the substance on the paper, reacted. And the stronger the energy, the farther the action took. Now, any grade school kid could probably tell you how this works, or at least they understand that it does work. But there's more to this, something we don't always consider. We know that the iron filings didn't change, except in the way they took shape to match the magnetic field. But what about the magnet itself? What about this iron bar, the thing that was generating the field, causing the stuff around it to take shape? Because that's the part our thoughts play, the magnet, all right, in the creative process of life. You see, when an iron bar is magnetized, and if I was David Barrett, I'd have two bars here, and I'd be using, you know, props, whatever, but I'm not. When a piece of iron is magnetized, it is no different in substance from a non-magnetized piece of iron. The molecules inside of it, the physical makeup, none of those things change. It looks the same. It feels the same. It weighs the same as before it was magnetized. The only difference is in the arrangement of the molecules. In the arrangement of the molecules. When the iron molecules in there are randomly arranged, like they are with a normal piece of iron, we call it demagnetized, and it has no effect at all on the world around it. It's just a lump of iron. But when the molecules are given direction, either deliberately or by accident, that is when all of them line up facing the same way, all or most of them, then the result is something that we call a magnetic field. Now, the electrical energy within the molecules doesn't change. It's the same positive, negative electrons and stuff within the molecule. It just gets focused in the same direction. Focused in the same direction. And that is what allows it to use the charge that it always had but wasn't using to accomplish something specific that it couldn't accomplish before. A total difference. Now, the same principle works, the same scientific principle, at the spiritual level. All right? It's what we are all equally capable of doing with this power we already have that fills every cell of our being. Every cell of our being, with this intelligence that makes up every part of our consciousness. If we allow our thoughts and our beliefs and our emotions and our passions to be scattered in all directions jumping all around, reacting to every alarm bell that the world sets off, getting caught up in every story that they put out on the news, believing in all the dangers and limitations that the world tells us are real. If we do that, we will never generate enough energy, concentrated, focused energy, to attract into our life the things we want to attract. But if we take control of our thoughts and we refuse to get confused or distracted, if we focus our attention on giving our thoughts and desires and beliefs conscious direction, and if we stick with that direction, no matter what, we will automatically generate an attracting energy in that direction. Like a tractor beam on Star Trek, if you're familiar with that, okay? And we will draw to us everything that is in tune with the force that we're putting out. That's how the law of attraction works. Now, we have to realize this is not just one of God's arbitrary rules to make life complicated, all right? It's a law that works at every single level of the universe, a natural scientific principle. Going down to every single atom in the universe has an attraction between the positive and the negative forces that keeps them in balance. All the planets, all the stars in the universe are kept in balance by a certain attractive force, all right? Life continues and procreates on Earth and anywhere else that life exists, probably because of an attraction between people. Now, we can call this magnetic attraction in the case of the atoms and the molecules. We can call it gravity in the case of the planets. We can call it sexual attraction in terms of people. It's all part of the same law that permeates the universe. As co-creators with God of our experience, understanding this principle of mental attraction is an important tool we have to have in our metaphysical toolbox. But just like a lot of tools, if you don't know how to use it, you can hurt yourself. You know, reference a circular saw, all right, something like that. We can attract negative and unpleasant experiences just as easily as we can attract positive and happy experiences. Because this law works both ways. It works both ways. That's what that statement means in the Christian New Testament. God makes the rain fall on the just and the unjust. The same law works the same way for everybody. Dr. Holmes talks about spiritual attraction this way. He says, in a later book, he says, we can so fill ourselves with the drawing power of attraction that it will become irresistible. Irresistible, all right? Nothing can hinder the person who knows that they are dealing with the one power that creates all from itself, that moves all within itself, and yet holds everything in its place. Holds everything in its place. The key here is that life, through the law of attraction, doesn't bring us what we'd like to have. It brings us what we emphasize and what we expect. What we emphasize and what we expect. That's the part most of us need to focus on, that we need to learn. Now, one more interesting thing about this law is that most people tend to use it on a very simplistic level. And I think a lot of us did when we first showed up in a place like this. I still hear people saying, this is great, now I can attract money, you know, a better looking boyfriend or girlfriend, whatever it is, a car, a parking space to put the car in, you know, all that kind of stuff. All my problems are solved. I've heard people say that. But that's not quite the way it worked out for a lot of them, all right? Because eventually we figured out that our real problem was not our inability to get stuff. Our real problem was that we had no idea what kind of a life we wanted to create. That was the real problem. It took a while. For some of us, a long while, all right? It took a while for some of us to figure out that this isn't about attracting a date. It's about learning how to become more loving so that we're always attracting into our sphere, our atmosphere, people who love us as much as we love them, all right? It isn't about attracting more money. It's about learning that there's a constant flow of abundance in the universe that we participate in by both giving generously and by allowing ourselves to receive. That's how we attract prosperity. It isn't about attracting the best, most prestigious job. It's about learning how to freely express our own individual creativity in whatever way we desire. That's how we attract the work that we love. In other words, this law is all about discovering that what we become in our consciousness, that's important. Not what we think, not what we hope, not what we want. What we become in our consciousness, in our heart and mind, will automatically attract to us, with little or no effort on our part, who and what we truly are, what we have become. And when that happens in us, not to us, in us, then the people and the things and the experiences who support what we are will be drawn to us like a moth to a flame. They really, really will. It'll be like the difference between catching fish with a fishing pole or sitting back and watching them jump into the boat. It really can feel like that. Now, one of my favorite statements by Dr. Holmes, and I've got a lot of favorites, is in this chapter, and he says, "Nothing moves but mind." Great statement. Nothing moves but mind. He says, God makes things through the direct act of becoming the things which it creates. That's how the law of attraction works. Now, that's not just the truth about God. It is the truth about us. That's how our individual life is created too. And we can call what we do attraction or prayer or visualizing or positive imaging, which is what Dr. Norman Vincent Peale called it, or spiritual mind treatment, as Dr. Holmes calls it. It's all the same thing. It's all the same thing. At the highest level of expression, it is simply our conscious and deliberate use of the law of mind to attract into our life a greater understanding of the presence of God as a creative power in everything we do. And in a spiritual universe where our thoughts have so much power, that's all we need to learn and all we need to know. This is the truth in your life, and this is the truth in mine. And so it is. And so it is. All right. Thank you. All right. Thank you. I'll let Eric get situated here with his noisemaker. Let's take a moment. A lot of ideas here. Take the ones that resonated with you. I give them to you freely. Set aside the others for later. And let's know this. We are powerful beings. Not because of who we are, but because of what we are. Each one of us is an individual expression in the mind of God. Each one of us is a focal point of all the creative power in the universe, expressed through our thoughts and feelings. Each one of us has the ability to create our life as an experience that feeds us, that allows us not only to enjoy the life we're living, but to expand our life into a greater world for everyone. This is how powerful we are. As each of us is made in the image and likeness of this power that creates all out of itself, we become the positive expression of this power. So knowing this, we focus not on getting things or manipulating people. We focus on being love and peace and kindness and prosperity and health and joy in everything we do. We attract to us that which we love by becoming that which we love. Like does attract like. So as we recognize this, we begin to experience our relationships differently with our neighbors, with our friends, with our family, at work. We create a space in our own consciousness for the people around us to be the best that they can be, as we create a space in our own mind to be the best that we can be. And in doing so, we alter the energy where we are. The atmosphere around us, which becomes positive and loving, touches the atmosphere of others, and the power of love and peace overcomes anger and disruption every time. So knowing this, we talk to people, we drive on the same streets with people, we watch the people on the news and on the internet, and we don't judge. We don't condemn. We don't fight. We don't take ideas that do not serve us or the world. We choose the ideas we have. We choose love and peace and kindness in everything we do. And as we do, we give thanks. We give thanks for these laws that allow us to be so powerful in this physical world. We give thanks for all that we have been given and all that we have yet to give. And as we do so, we are transformed. Our life is transformed, and the world is transformed. This is our truth. We accept it, we embrace it, and we release it into consciousness, letting it be the truth for us and every other person now and always. Join me in saying, and so it is.